So we're making better decisions, and the fruit quality should even be better on this next go around.
In the present, I need to evolve, I need to change lots of things.
Okay, I think a few times they asked me, Giovanni, do you have fun in what you're doing?
Well, you reinvent yourself, right? I think that's really where that begins and ends.
I think 18's legendary. It's gonna go down in history.
I haven't made the same wine twice, have no intention of duplicating anything.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 345. This week we feature Eric Risch of Pellet Estate, Napa Valley.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Henry Pellet holds an important place in Napa Valley history. Pellet was an experimenter and an innovator. But we'll let Eric Risch tell you about that. Eric is the general manager and director of winemaking at Pellet Estate. Eric filled us in on the history of this estate when we visited him a few weeks ago. A fun fact, Tom Rinaldi, who we interviewed on podcast number 341, is the winemaker for Pellet. American winemaking may be young, but it's grown up very quickly. You can hear Eric on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term barnyard. Well, another beautiful day in Napa Valley, and we have an audience today, too. I'm here with Eric Risch of Pellet Estate, and we're at Pellet Estate. This is wonderful.
Welcome, Ray. I'm glad you're able to come. This estate is pretty much steeped in history as being the second commercial vineyard that's the oldest in Napa Valley. Charles Krug was the first. This was established in 1863 by Henry Pellet, one of the true pioneers of Napa Valley. He was one of St. Helena's first mayors. He was one of the founding members of Appellation St. Helena, which was back then known as the St. Helena Viticulture Society. He was a founding member of the California Wine Commission in Sacramento in our state capital. It's just amazing what the gentleman had done along with his neighbors, Dr. Charles Crane, which is the next vineyard over, Charles Krug, H.W. Crabb, who founded Tokalon. Those guys really put Napa Valley back on the map in 1875 with the formation of Appellation St. Helena. And it's just Cabernet Central here. And Henry Pellet actually went over to Europe and brought back about 60 different rootstocks and varietals to experiment on his neighbor Dr. Crane's land, where he built a nursery while he was also farming Dr. Crane's land for him, taking care of his vines and making his wine. At one time, Henry Pellet cellar here was considered one of the most finest examples of California cellars, producing over 80,000 gallons. He later went on to form Pellet and Carver Winery here that lasted until about 1890 or so, and then he finally passed away in 1912. The property basically was just producing grapes and it was being sold over the years. Went fallow during Prohibition, and in 2010, I worked with the owners to reestablish this winery here, bring its former glory back to life, replanted the rose in 2005, and here we are today and celebrating our 10th harvest.
It's a beautiful place to be. And just as a curious question to a winemaker, you ever thought about what it might have been like if there was no Prohibition, where the wine industry in the States would have gone?
I think it would have really ratcheted up a lot more quickly. With that little pause there, it put us behind Europe a lot. French wines, you know, were really dominant, you know, when I was growing up in St. Louis area, and California wine still was non-existent in the Midwest radar from when I was a young child. And from my parents, my grandfather actually was importing a lot of European wines from both Austria, France, and Germany all throughout my father's growing up in his childhood. And that's what we learned, you know, to appreciate, you know, as children growing up. And it wasn't really until the 80s, in the late 70s and 80s, that I, you know, we kind of rediscovered California wines, and I think it really set us behind.
Yeah, quite a bit. Now, are you from California originally, or?
No, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri originally, and grew up there, born and raised there, and grew up in doing the family construction business there, but was always involved in food and wine. My parents would go over to Europe back in the early and mid, late 70s, and they would take cooking classes all over Europe, and then they would bring back up-and-coming rising chefs to stay with us for a week while they gave cooking classes downtown in St. Louis. And so it was just a food extravaganza, learned how to cook, you know, classical French, provincial French, Viennese cooking, Florentine cooking. So we're always making pasta. Food and wine has been an integral part of my life ever since I was old enough to walk.
How'd you manage to stay so skinny?
Good genes, good Austrian genes, I guess.
So that's not a bad thing. So for you, you know, obviously you were around this and you had created a love for wine, but when did you come out here and what did you think about this idea of becoming a winemaker?
Well, I came out to California in 1985 and was attending University of San Francisco, and I needed a job to pay for extracurricular activities. So I actually began a career in the digital processing section for Northern California for Wells Fargo Bank. And so I worked the midnight shift, and I really got into computers and all the big mainframe processing and the computer and IT. All that technology really fascinated me. And so then I switched into information systems management program at USF, then left Wells Fargo, worked for a couple more companies and did some consulting with Apple Computer, Claris Corporation, way back in the day. And then I decided I would branch out onto my own and formed a company called Grapevine Software Corporation. And I named it Grapevine Software after my love and passion for wine, because my end goal was always to come up and basically build and run a winery. And sold that and wound that down in the early 2000s during the tech crash, and actually moved up here and reinvented myself again as what I am today.
So the idea, though, of making wine, I mean, it's a passion, it's involved, yeah. It's a science. I mean, obviously with your background, I mean, that had to be kind of a scary jump, though, to go from where you'd been.
Yes and no, because I helped a lot of companies and during my tech days at Grapevine, you know, create something from nothing. And that's really what I've always kind of been about. I grew up doing residential construction, building something from nothing, working with your hands. In the tech industry, we're at the dawn of the internet, creating websites for people out of nothing, just electrons, and always taking risks. And some were successful, some were not so successful. So risk-taking is nothing new for me, but just the idea of creating something from nothing and building it up, whether it's a brand, whether it's a company, whether it's a family.
That's very cool. So what do you like to drink?
I like to drink all sorts of wines, but I particularly really appreciate red wine, Cabernet-based varietals. I grew up drinking French Bordeaux, so anything from Pouillac or the Right Bank and Saint-Emilion, Saint-Estèphe. Those are the fun ones for me, and that's just basically harkens back to my parents' cellar was very, very extensive. I was very fortunate enough to actually experience a lot of the great wines from Bordeaux from the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. My father was very ambitious about his collection, and so he would buy a diverse amounts of Bordeaux, and we'd always be having tastings or parties over and pairing that with men's cooking groups. His cooking group was called Der Feinschmeckers, and it was all his male buddies, and they would get together about every 4 months or so at one person's house, and they would cook all day, and then they go home, clean up, then the wives would come, we'd have dinner, and I was the busboy, the wine steward, and the dishwasher crew. Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, the cool thing about having you here today is we also have your consulting winemaker, Tom Rinaldi, here. Tom, step on in and say hi real quick.
I want you to step in.
Hi, Ray.
There we go.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you again.
So the two of you work pretty good together, I'm guessing, or otherwise you would have killed each other right now, probably, right?
Yeah.
How would you describe your working relationship, Tom?
Well, he does all the marketing, sales, promotion, and I do the physical production. That's what I enjoy doing. And get to make the picking decisions too. I think that's a crucial aspect to successful winemaking in Napa Valley.
So his hands are purple from ink and yours are purple from grapes.
Exactly.
That's a fair way to put it.
And his teeth are more purple than mine.
Tom, thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure.
All right. So back to where we were before that crazy guy jumped in the middle of our screen.
Now, Tom's an icon of the valley here. I'm very, very fortunate to work with him. And I couldn't ask for a better working partner than Tom.
Not only that, but he's got a... You've got a bit of a sense of humor, which doesn't hurt.
Oh, that it's a lot of fun to work with Tom and to travel with Tom.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. So how many acres are you farming here?
We're farming about 4 acres here. The property is about 5 acres in total. The original parcel was about 40 acres, but it's over the years it's been subdivided into 5 and 10 acre parcels.
Tell me what grapes you're farming. Again, I know you mentioned before, but I'm
what we farm here is Cabernet Merlot. We used to farm a little bit of Petit Verdot, but the Merlot, according to Tom here and my palate as well, is some of the best I've ever tasted, and Tom's tasted in the valley here. So we regrafted a couple years ago all the Petit Verdot. There was only a small amount of vines because we only used a small amount of it in our, as a blend of our percentage, 2 or 3%. So it's basically all Cabernet, two types of Cabernet. We grow a clone 337. And a clone 4 Cabernet. The 4 is known a little bit more for its blue notes, and the 337 has a little bit more backbone and tannic structure to it, a little earth to it. And then we also contract 4 grapes from the Petaluma Gap for our Chardonnay program, and we contract on two clones of Chardonnay, a clone 124 from Epernay, which is the backbone of our Unoaked Chardonnay program, and we harvest a clone 95, which is part of our barrel fermenter program. Mm.
Now you do your tastings here in this area. We're in the pool house at the estate.
Mm. Yeah. Tasting lounge when I'm here.
Tasting lounge. We're in the tasting lounge. And really, a great part of what you do is education for your guests, I'm imagining.
Absolutely. I mean, we get people from all over the country and literally all over the world will come in. We don't do tastings very often. It's based on Tom or I's availability or both, since we both are quite busy and travel a lot. But it's we invite people out. It's about an hour, hour and a half experience. We sit down, we taste through about 5 or 6 different wines, have a conversation about wine, the property, life, anything. And it's just very casual. And it's meant to just be an experience that's not very rigid or snooty.
Good. No, we definitely don't want snooty. But I'm curious, you know, when you're talking to people, and maybe you have people that are less experienced in wine, you know, do you find it a challenge to try and get your ideas across to them? Kind of like we talk about wine not being scary.
Yeah, not really, because once you build a camaraderie with people and they're relaxed and they're at ease, especially after they've had their first glass of wine there, it, you know, the conversation just kind of evolves on its own there. And, you know, you find out what terms that they're familiar with, what really strikes, you know, their palate. I mean, like, we have 2 styles of Chardonnay. One's stainless steel and one's a barrel fermented. One goes through malolactic secondary fermentation that gives it some butter notes, and the other one is crisp and clean. So when you get somebody that says, well, I really like Sauvignon Blanc, but I don't really care for Chardonnay, I'll put the Unoaked in front of them and it changes their mind. You get another gentleman that comes in and says, you know, I really like my French Pouilly Montrachet. So I'm like, well, here, we'll try this, try the barrel fermented version. And then just kind of guide it through that way.
Yeah, that's good. Do you ever find yourself battling the classic phrase that I really generally dislike immensely myself, the ABC, when it comes to Chardonnay?
Yes. Yes.
How do you deal with that?
Well, I don't really take offense to it there, but it's just ignorance. That's really all it is. It's people haven't been exposed to much, or what they have been exposed to is not their style. And there's so many styles of Chardonnay that are out in the world that run the gamut. And there's something, I believe there's something for everybody. And even with our particular Chardonnay program, it's literally 6 of one and half a dozen of the other. We'll have a husband and wife team come up to a commercial tasting, and one likes one style, one likes the other style, and they each go home with a bottle, and they're happy.
And that's what it's all about, is being happy when you leave.
It's all about exploring. Never stop trying. I mean, I'll try anything once, twice if I like it.
Excellent. That's what I want to hear. So in all the time you've been doing this, and I'm sure you've done your share of interviews and media, that sort of thing, what's the question that you don't get asked that you would like to be asked?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I'm asked all sorts of interesting questions. I think the one question that nobody has asked me that I think that would be interesting to answer is, why are you so passionate about food and wine together? And that stems from my upbringing, and where food and wine went hand in hand. It's generally, I get asked wine questions, and I'll put food pairings together, and I'll do winemaker dinners, but food's not as big of a focus as the wine questions are. And I think there's some, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship between food and wine for myself personally. And where I can think of a particular food, and I know the why I want to drink with it. Or I can think of a particular wine, and I know what food I want to eat with it.
So that's a real natural thing for you to pairing. Yeah. And that's got to be great advice to give people who are tasting here, because some people just simply fumble at something like that.
I've seen that happen before. And what I do often is I have a printout of recipe entree collections that I've put together from winemaker dinners I've done in the past. And I put it in a vertical chart there with each of the varietals that we're tasting. And I ask people to envision and visualize when they're drinking this wine, what it would be like to be pairing it with this food. So if it's the unoaked Chardonnay, I said, imagine you're eating smoked trout with horseradish cream on this, or ceviche by the pool on a 90-degree day. How would this go together in your mind? And the light bulb starts to go off with them a little bit. Mm.
That's nice. That's a good way to go about that. So what do you see as the greatest challenge, though, when you run into a situation where, and we hear this commonly these days, Napa wines are not inexpensive, and they're probably going to continue going up. Of course, that always depends on weather. But how do you deal with that sometimes?
It's just a function of economics is my response. I mean, we're going to have increased labor costs, real estate prices go up, you know, production prices will always increase. It's not, you know, you can talk about, oh, this bottle of Robert Mondavi Reserve back in the day was only $45 for back in the mid-80s, and now it's $150, $200. And well, that's just the CPI. It worked for you.
It's cost and labor.
Thank you. Yeah. And that takes me to labor. A lot of wineries, not just in the United States, but around the world, are having issues with getting good labor to do what needs to be done. I know it's happened here in the Valley. How about you? Has it affected you directly?
It hasn't really affected us. I mean, we're very small and nimble. It's basically Tom and myself, and we have a great vineyard management crew with Doug White and his guys. We're not the Behringers of the Valley, where if we want to call a pick and it involves 100 acres and you need to really amass a big force to do that, everything that we do is by hand from vineyard to bottle. A lot of the larger properties in the Valley, they're employing machine harvesting, you know, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just the realities of it. But with only 4 acres, I mean, we can have 2 crews of 16 guys pick this thing out in like 4 hours.
Nice. So you have kind of a shorter harvest, I guess, when you get right down to it, huh?
It is. We pick a little bit on the earlier side than some of the other people that I know. A lot of people will, you know, try and hang it out there a little bit longer, get the sugars up. But for us, it's all about taste, and especially Tom. Tom's taste, when he's out in the vineyard, he's like, this is ripe. Ripeness is what drives everything. The sugar can be high, the sugar can be a little bit low, up, but if the ripeness isn't there, if the, you know, the phenolics aren't right, if the flavor's not there, you know, your acid balance and your sugar balance is not really going to matter at the end of the day.
So he's more shooting from the hip, but that comes from a lot of years.
That comes from 45 years of experience with Tom. That's why we're very fortunate to have him on our team.
So with the business being like it is today, is there anything that you can talk about, that you want to talk about, that makes you crazy about the wine business?
The thing that drives me and keeps me up at night sometimes is customers around the country that want our wine, but I can't ship to them because of the direct-to-consumer shipping laws or DTC laws and the 3 or 4 tier systems in some of the states. I think, you know, at some point for small producers that are, say, under 10,000 cases, it would be just nice to have an exemption from the TTB across all the states and, you know, dry counties, wet counties. It's just, there's about 5 states out there right now, and I won't particularly name those states. But it's just difficult. I mean, we've gotten 1 cease and desist letter from one particular state already there. But it was a gentleman who came out with his marketing team. He had our wine in Las Vegas and went home and just said it was the most wonderful wine, and he wanted a case of it, and so we shipped him a case, and he said, don't worry, because it's fine, and
it wasn't
fine.
Yeah, they take that thing very seriously.
They do.
And, you know, it's kind of ironic where we have this world of where our government's trying to be less hands-on in the states, and it gets really out of hand when it comes to individual states and their laws. And it's not just for people like you who are selling it, it's people like me who want to buy it.
Correct. And I understand the need for regulation and the, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms industry and things like that. You know, it's important to have, laws like that in place. But I think they need to be universally applied, across the states. And I know there's lots of different lobbyists, from whether it's the distilled spirits industry to, in-house producers. And I mean, it has been getting better. I mean, there's laws now that it's like, well, if you make wine in a state and you ship it out of state, you can have out-of-state shipments into the state.
Nice. Yeah, it's a complicated situation because then on top of it, you had to deal with compliance with the states that you can ship to, and that's a lot of paperwork.
That is true, and it's a huge amount of paperwork. Of course, going state by state for the compliance, I mean, I actually hire a consultant to help me with that because it would be impossible for me to do what I do and also keep up with all the compliance laws. And besides compliance, there's also tide house laws that you need to worry about. And for small producers like ourselves and a lot of us in the Valley here, we want to be able to advertise if we're going to someplace or post something on social media, and we'd be in violation of certain tide house laws and get our wrist slapped or a fine or a license revoked because of inappropriately promoting our brand in partnership with like maybe a winemaker dinner at a restaurant. That you need to get it from a particular distributor. You can't do that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I was talking about winemakers living in the past, the present, the future, and all these different things you do with. But geez, and the winemakers are weathermen. But yeah, you're a little bit of a lawyer there too, aren't you?
You're so many hats, from intellectual property all the way down to farming.
There really is no other business that could be compared to winemaking, and even other farming really doesn't come that close because of. You're a manufacturer, you're a retailer, you're a wholesaler, you're all that stuff.
That's true. But that's one of the things I enjoy most because it's just a myriad of responsibilities. And there's always something new. There's always a new challenge, and I'm always up for challenges.
Good for you. You're a very responsible guy. Not always something that's associated with the wine business sometimes.
It doesn't mean I always like everything that I do about my job, like compliance speaking, tax forms. No, I don't. If you showed me anybody that really liked doing the taxing and the compliance, that's why I would say I'd like to talk to you about outsourcing.
Yeah, I think they'd be nuts. Although from what I understand, from what I see just in my state, a lot of stuff is already done online, so it's a lot easier to get through than it used to be.
There is a lot, but there's some states that are still behind the curve a little bit. There's one state in the Midwest where I went to renew my wholesaler permit this week, and it said right there on the form, please log into the website here and type in your name and number, and it wasn't working when I called them up, and they're like, well, that's not for you guys, that's just for your average consumers. And you still need to sign it and mail it in snail mail. And it was just $50.
I imagine the best way to really try and taste your wines would be to buy it or to contact you guys via the web. And what is your website for our listeners?
Our website is pelletestate.com. There's a wealth of information up there. We've got videos with Tom explaining exactly how each of our four labels are made, from our Henry's Reserve, which is the best of the best that we produce off our property, to our Cabernet Sauvignon, our barrel fermented Chardonnay, and the unoaked Chardonnay. Certain years we do make 100% Merlot, not every year. We didn't do it last year. Some years we make a Cabernet Rosé. That's 100% Cabernet Sauvignon Rosé. Very unique, but it doesn't happen every year.
Yeah, that's great. Eric, I really appreciate you taking the time, especially day after auction where everybody's kind of crawling around trying to find their footing.
It's been a busy, successful auction week here for us. Auction Napa Valley is just a gem of an organization, the Napa Valley Vintners, which we're members of, and they raised so much money for all the services here in the Valley, and 100% of the proceeds go to fund those services. And I think this year we're pushing almost $180-190 million in totality over the course of the years raised for charities here in the Valley.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Ray.
Learn more by visiting pelletestate.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff.
Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.